In 1998, when Croatia shattered mighty Germany with 3 goals, Davor Šuker's screams were the screams of the people who had recently gained independence after a bloody civil war. In the 1990 World Cup, when Rijkaard spit in Voller's hair, for the people of the Netherlands, it was a symbol of hatred towards the German occupiers. It's true, the World Cup unites people in a country and gives them the feeling of pride. There's a significant reason behind that. Players play with their country's national kits and under their flags and are considered a sample of their own society. The happy and boundless culture of Brazilians can be spotted in their artistic play. The hard work and discipline of the Japanese stands out in their courageous style of playing. Germans play football like machines, just like their culture.
A quick German thrust puts Vots clean through.
Actually, teams are considered their nation's representatives in the World Cup in every aspect. World Cup is a World Cup because the coaches, reporters, spectators, and everyone else knows that it isn't just about football matches. This is the place where people's national identities, and even more than that, emerge. People in underprivileged countries always get happy when weak countries win. People always get happy when their traditional rival loses. Even those who migrated from their homeland many years ago and don't even speak their mother tongue any longer find their lost nationalistic feeling during the World Cup matches. If we take a look at history, this characteristic has always been inherent in the World Cup. The first World Cup was held under heavy nationalistic feelings. Uruguay was the host and wanted to achieve pride for the less-known country by hosting the event. They did everything they could to gain the pride. They sold their agricultural products at the lowest price. They increased the tax on people's basic commodities. They sold bonds. That was how they managed to construct the largest stadium in the world. They held the first World Cup in history and became the champion. The final match was held between Argentina and Uruguay, two neighboring countries with deep-rooted hostilities. And after the final match, people in Buenos Aires pelted rocks at the Uruguay diplomatic mission. Later on, the World Cup champion in 1934 and 1938 took advantage of the patriotism to become the champion. Vittorio Pozzo, when Mussolini's rule had summarized the life of Italian in patriotism, would take his players to the ruins of the First World War and would force them to sing military songs. Two consecutive championships in the World Cup boosted the nationalistic and fascist feelings in Italy. In the final match of the World Cup in 1950, when 183,000 people gathered in the Maracana Stadium, the mayor of Rio de Janeiro delivered a speech. He said he was sure that his country was already the winners. Uruguay's amazing win in the most dramatic final in history turned the stadium into a huge cemetery. Brazil remained mired in grief for weeks, while people in Montevideo were walking on the streets and whispering their national anthem. The story continued. When Germany played Hungary in the final match in 1954, the Germans' boundless zeal changed the result.
Through into the center, and a shot, yes, a goal! A goal scored by Müller.
Their resistance in the face of striking attacks by Hungary and the splendid comeback. They wanted to revive their pride lost in the World War, and they succeeded. In the 1950s, the French got Moroccan Jos Fontaine on their team.
This time it's Dewey who gets his name on the score sheet.
In the 60s, the Portuguese used Mozambican Eusebio. In the following years, the Netherlands used Surinamese stars. The players would reach the national team from the colonized countries and save the national team. It was a sample of what the colonizing power did. It was a country that could bring far-flung countries under its flag.
Always danger, lays it outside and finds Valdana. He can't turn. Maradona's there, rises above ship. And is that goal going to be allowed?
Maradona displayed the biggest national show in the history of the World Cup. He scored the most spectacular goal in history. He scored, in fact, the most controversial goal in history and humiliated aggressor Britain all by himself. Maradona took revenge for the Belgrano ship that was sunk after sailing for 12,000 kilometers to occupy his country. By just a scurry look at history, you'll see several other vivid examples. Iranian players sacrificed themselves in front of the U.S. North Korean players showed a lot of bravery against powerful Brazilians. Who can claim that the old scores between countries are not effective in clashes amid World Cup matches? Like this strange foul by Tony Schumacher or the famous headbutt by Zidane. Or even the fight between Simeone and Beckham. It's true, the history of the World Cup is affected by the zeal for nationality more than anything else. Let's not forget that the World Cup isn't just about football matches. The World Cup is the biggest international event on our planet, where nations fight against each other with all their national symbols and try to defend their credit. It's a good opportunity for different groups in a country to converge. It's a good opportunity to bolster national pride in nations that have been humiliated. It's a good opportunity to achieve victory, revenge, and to be seen. Everyone knows that. People who wave their national flags on the streets, the players who wholeheartedly throw themselves in front of the ball, politicians and the media. Let's not forget that the World Cup is an opportunity to analyze nations as they really are and to see the national identity of people more deeply. It's a time to discover the state of the world. This time, we could watch it a little deeper. This is called football. Watch it carefully.
این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
الله يا الله سبحان الله الله يا الله والحمد لله الله ولا إله إلا الله الله يا الله والله أكبر.
February 1st, 1979. Mehrabad Airport, Tehran, Iran. The return of Imam Khomeini to Tehran after 15 years in exile. Imam Khomeini's historic speech outlining the state of affairs of the course of the revolution. Audience, millions of people. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, I would like to express my gratitude to the various strata of the nation for their devotion. The devotion of the Iranian nation is a heavy burden upon my shoulders for which I cannot compensate. I also would like to thank the clergy for their self-sacrificing devotion and endurance in facing all the difficulties during the past course of events. I also would like to thank the university students who have undergone hardships, the merchants and traders who have been subjected to inconveniences, the young people of the bazaar and universities and science schools who have shed their blood in these affairs, the university professors, the justice ministry, its judges and lawyers, all the classes of the people, the employees, the workers, the farmers, and all the ranks of the nation. You have gained victory through your exceptional efforts in unity of expression.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum. This is Ali, and we are trying to present some of the sayings of the late Imam Khomeini, rahmatullahi alayhi, on the victory of the Islamic Revolution, Islamic Republic, in 22nd of Bahman. Imam rahmatullahi alayhi says, 22nd of Bahman marks the beginning of the Iranian nation's victory over the arrogant and looters. 22nd of Bahman marks the beginning of the dismantling of the taghut, an oppressive system, and marks the beginning of God's ruling over the world. The 22nd of Bahman marks the beginning of the raising of the flag of Islamic justice and the awakening of the oppressed over the country. And the great nation of Iran, and blessings to all Muslims, and oppressed and deprived. Well, dear brothers and sisters, you see in these sayings of Imam rahmatullah alayhi, he looks at the Islamic Revolution as something universal which belongs to all the Muslims and all the humanity. He says that this revolution is not only for Iranian. I mean, though he mentions the nation, he says the blessings will be for the whole humanity. It has actually deep meaning in it that Imam rahmatullah alayhi, that the late Imam Khomeini, knows this revolution not only for the Iranian. This revolution is not only for Iranians. All the oppressed systems are going to be affected by this revolution, and all the deprived and all the oppressed nations will be benefited from the blessings of this revolution. Undoubtedly, the victory of the Islamic Revolution, in addition to the factor of leadership that actually plays an essential role and unique characteristics of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh, it has some other factors. That is the angle of people and the angle of religion and beliefs. So if we want to look at this revolution, we can say that it has three angles, that one of which is the people. The people were those who helped the leadership to reach to the goals, to achieve the goals.
As-salamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll try to have a look at the commentary of Chapter Shu'ara, the 26th chapter of the Holy Quran. We'll be back after you listen to the verses we're going to discuss in this episode, 158th and 159th verses.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
فأخذهم العذاب إن في ذلك لآية وما كان أكثرهم مؤمنين.
And the punishment seized them. Indeed, in that is a sign, but most of them were not to be believers.
وَإِنَّ رَبَّكَ لَهُوَ الْعَزِيزُ الرَّحِيمُ
And indeed, your Lord, He is the exalted in might, the merciful.
فَأَخَذُهُمُ الْعَذَابُ إِنَّ فِي ذَلِكَ لَآيَةٌ وَمَا كَانَ أَكْثَرُهُمْ مُؤْمِنِينَ وَإِنَّ رَبَّكَ لَهُوَ الْعَزِيزُ الرَّحِيمُ So the punishment overtook them. Verily, in this there is sign, but most of them do not believe. وَإِنَّ رَبَّكَ لَهُوَ الْعَزِيزُ الرَّحِيمُ And verily, your Lord, He is certainly the mighty, the merciful. So, as we said in the previous episodes, these disobedient groups of people of Thamud, not for understanding the right thing, but for seeking pretext, they asked Salih for a miracle. He brought for them miracle because he had to complete the argument for them. And قال هذه ناقة. He said, there is a she-camel, and the camel in a miraculous way came out of the inside of a mountain. But they, in the end, عقروها. They hamstrung her, and the Holy Quran said, فأقروها فأصبحوا نادمين. When they saw the divine punishment was close, they became regretful of what they had done. As a result, the 158th verse says, فَأَخَذَهُمُ الْعَذَابِ إِنَّ فِي ذَٰلِكَ لَآيَةٌ وَمَا كَانَ أَكْثَرُهُمْ مُؤْمِنِينَ So the punishment overtook them. Verily, in this there is sign, but most of them do not believe. Blasphemy is so important that for killing an animal, sometimes a group of people may be destroyed by divine punishment. They hamstrung her, so the divine punishment overtook them. The wrath and punishment of Allah is because of our own deed. Else He is merciful, since the verse says, إِنَّ رَبَّكَ لَهُوَ الْعَزِيزُ الرَّحِيمُ Your Lord is the merciful, so whatever you do to cause the chastisement of the Almighty Allah, it is on your hands, it is because of yourselves. So, in this holy verse, the Holy Quran implies that since their rebellion exceeded the limits, they actually showed that they would not accept the truth, the will of Allah, or the divine providence was to purify the face of the earth from the dirt of their existence, and He, subhanahu wa ta'ala, annihilated them. So the verse says, فَأَخَذَهُمُ الْعَذَابِ So the punishment overtook them.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly The Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
إِلَى الْإِبْلِ كَيْفَ خُلِقَ إِلَى
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
As it is explained in the different verses of the Holy Quran, it seems that a severe earthquake did shake their land, and when they woke up, they were sitting on their knees, and the event did not give them any respite. It was a fatal lightning which was accompanied with earthquake. So this is what ruined the walls over them. And at the same time, they died in an astonishing horror. At the end of the explanation of the event, the Holy Quran repeats the same thing that was stated at the end of the explanations of the previous events of the people of Hud, the people of Noah, and the people of Abraham. It says, إِنَّ فِي ذَلِكَ لَآيَةٌ. Verily in this, there is a sign, but most of them do not believe. وَمَا كَانَ أَكْثَرُهُمْ مُؤْمِنِينَ. This verse implies that with the effort and endeavor of this great prophet, Prophet Salih, and the sufferings that he tolerated while he had a great logic, those black-hearted, ungodly, disobedient people obstinately showed their opposition with that awakening miracle, and consequently, they encountered an evil destiny, which is an instructive lesson for others. Yes, none can defeat the power of Allah, as this great might is not a hinder for His mercy to be showered over His friends and even over His enemies. That's why the verse says, وَإِنَّ رَبَّكَ لَهُوَ الْعَزِيزُ الرَّحِيمُ. Verily, your Lord is certainly the mighty, the merciful. Thus, not only His mercy and favors are the signs of admonition, but also His wrath and punishment works as a sign. Thank you for staying with us, dear listeners. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets this life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also visit our website at parsetoday.ir. Until the next program, take care.
Things goodbye. Always worked for me. Worry ends when faith begins.
Aperture.
A museum to wonder and reflect, a prison for torture and control, and a spectacular palace fit for a king. Perhaps one might think that these three places don't have the faintest connection with each other. But it's amazing to see that the thread of time has woven them together to create the tapestry of the Qasr edifice. In this week's documentary, we take you to Tehran to explore a dreadful metamorphosis through time, the history of a palace that turned into a prison. But the story does not end there. The Qasr edifice has witnessed 200 years of Iran's history, the demise of the monarch era, and the birth of a revolution. Now, after more than decades since the Islamic Revolution in Iran, we bring you the untold stories of those who experienced the horrors of the edifice in its darkest years. Stay with us. Here's the first part.
''1979, Tehran. The
country is on the edge of a precipice. Street clashes are raging between the army and the people. Endless strikes are crippling the country. Prime ministers are being ousted one after another, and foreign nationals leaving the country. The Shah is helpless. The Shah is hopeless. Nothing can assuage the anger of the nation. A revolution is in sight. October the 24th, 1978. Tehran, the gas prison. A few months before the Islamic Revolution of Iran, a great number of political prisoners are released after years of being in prison and under torture. Since the beginning of the Pahlavi dynasty, the gas prison had been the graveyard of many political opponents. But within a few months, it would fall into the hands of revolutionaries and a new chapter in the history of this edifice would begin. The name of this prison still conjures up images of many contemporary Iranian figures that fought heart and soul against the Pahlavi regime. The Ghasr prison. Over the last two centuries, this building has undergone many fundamental changes, each one mirroring part of this land's history. Tehran, the Ghasr Garden Museum. In 2001, the Ghasr prison was closed down after 76 years. In a 10-year project, the municipality of Tehran converted it into the Ghasr Garden Museum. The museum has three main parts: the Markov prison, the political prison, and a large garden the prisons are located in. In the Garden Museum, exhibition stands have been set up, each one representing a critical moment in the history of Iran. A number of political prisoners during the Pahlavi era are here to recount their first-hand experiences for visitors. The building is located in the center of Tehran, but around 200 years ago, during the Qajar dynasty, it was miles away from the city, in a district known as Khurram Abad Hills. In 1798, Fath Ali Shah, the second king of the Qajar dynasty, ordered a recreational palace to be built outside Tehran, a great palace that cost the court dearly.
Tehrani che mo emruz ba in gostare va azamat shahid un hastim.
During the early years of the Qajar dynasty, Tehran, which was the capital city of the country, was about 6 kilometers away from where the Ghasr Garden Museum is now located in. In that era, this place was a green region with nice weather, to an extent that at the time it was known as Khurramabad, or a verdant place.
Iranian palaces share a similar structure. A large garden with small brooks running through, a stately summer house in the middle, and a luxurious mansion at the end with numerous rooms for the Shah and his wives. It is said the palace cost the Shah 400,000 tomans, a huge sum of money in those days. Many foreigners visited the palace, among them Samuel G.W. Benjamin, the U.S. ambassador to Tehran, Pierre Amédée Joubert, Napoleon Bonaparte's envoy to the court of Fath Ali Shah, and Madame Carla Serena. Visiting the palace, Madame Serena was impressed by the paintings she saw there. Writing in her travel log, "The palace has been heavenly decorated, and the paintings done in the most delicate fashion." In 1806, His Majesty spent 3 months of March, April, and May at this palace. But the glory days didn't last long. During the reign of Nasruddin Shah, the palace fell from grace and, abandoned, a devastating flood razed it to the ground. After that, its precincts were used as military camps and makeshift war prisons. But the future had something else in store. When Reza Shah came to the throne, the country's penal system needed a complete overhaul. The number of prisoners was growing and the old prisons no longer met international standards. The government had to establish modern prisons and recognize civil rights for its convicts.
During the Qajar dynasty, prison was not basically like the one in the Pahlavi era. It was a small building made up of three rooms and some rooms in the basement. This was the police's detention center during the Qajar dynasty. But with the growing confrontation between the Iranian nation and the Pahlavi regime, the number of prisoners increased and the regime was prompted to establish a big prison.
The Qajari prisons were old and small, more like dungeons than modern prisons, and couldn't accommodate the increasing number of prisoners. Brigadier Mohammad Dargahi, the Tehran chief of police, requested a new and larger prison. In 1927, Reza Shah commissioned Nikolai Markov, an Iranian architect of Georgian descent, to build the prison. Working for the municipality of Tehran, he had designed many buildings, including Tehran's post office and telecommunications and Alborz High School. Markov decided to build the prison in the south part of the dilapidated palace. The prison took 2 years to complete. In December 1929, it was opened with 192 rooms, designed to house 800 prisoners. In the opening ceremony, Brigadier Dargahi was showing the new prison to Reza Shah and other high-ranking officials. When the group reached the iron cell, the brigadier opened the door for the Shah and asked him and his entourage to step in. But the Shah refused to enter when he was warned by his court minister of a possible coup d'etat. 2 days later, Brigadier Dargahi was relieved of his command and became the first prisoner of this macabre prison. Under Reza Shah, the Ghass prison was the only prison in Tehran. In those days, prisoners were kept together without any classification. Many scholars, writers, and poets spent years of their lives within its walls. In the past, there were two underground canals that supplied drinking and irrigation water to the palace. Years later, when the palace was converted into the prison, the two canals had gushed out to the surface, and prisoners would quench their thirst from the freezing water. Hence the Persian idiom to drink cool water was coined, an idiom with a pleasant literal meaning but an unpleasant reference. Shot in 1958, the footage shows prisoners busy with various activities. The edifice has seen many hard days when Iran, under the boots of Russian and English troops during World War II, was occupied and ruined, accused of being a nest for German spies. They destroyed the country's army, toppled Reza Shah from the throne, forcing him to exile, and made his son Mohammad Reza the king of Iran. The occupying forces took all national resources into their hands, letting thousands of Iranians starve to death. The year 1953 is a year indelibly imprinted on the mind of the edifice. That year, Dr. Mohammad Mossadegh, the Prime Minister at the time, nationalized the oil industry, a success that enraged the United Kingdom and the United States of America. On the 19th of August 1953, in an Anglo-American coup, the Prime Minister was removed from power and many Iranian nationalists arrested. The edifice bore witness to the demise of a nation's hope. Mohammad Reza Shah, who had fled the country, returned a few days after the coup.
اگر اون نهضت به شکست منجر نمی‌شد، عملاً ملت ایران در
It's quite natural that hadn't that movement failed, the Iranian nation would have continued its journey toward its historical perfection in a natural fashion and experienced its local balanced development. But the meddling in the national movement by imperial powers, that is the US and the UK, interrupted the current of balance, intrinsic development in Iranian society.
و درون زای جامعه ایران با اخلال روبرو بشه.
After the 1953 coup d'etat, the nation's pent-up anger came to the surface every now and then, while the regime searched desperately for ways to curb the situation. In the mid-1950s, a new organization was established with the help of the CIA and the Mossad. SAVAK, or the Organization of Intelligence and National Security, aimed to counteract any security threat to the country. Dr. Javad Mansouri was a political prisoner before the 1979 revolution in different prisons across the country.
بعد از کودتای 28 مرداد 1332
After the 1953 coup d'etat, they decided to have a powerful organization to suppress the Iranian anti-imperialist movement, especially since the movement had continued for a long time and the regime was impotent. So in 1956, the bill was officially put forward and approved in Parliament, and with a design by the CIA, this organization was established. The CIA had even an office in Savak, and all plans, information exchanges, training, equipment were from the CIA.
و کل برنامه‌ها مبادله اطلاعات آموزش تجهیزات با CIA بود
Nipping any protest in the bud, Savak planned to round up all political dissidents in the country. A need for more prisons was urgent now. New prisons were built around the Markov prison. One of them was for political prisoners, where a large number of political opponents of different trends spent years of their lives.
دقیقاً بعد از کودتای 28 مرداد 1332 است که
Right after the 1953 coup d'etat, again due to the increase in the number of political prisoners and their inherent difference from criminals, in the early 1950s, a separate building was officially built as the political prison.
Of those prisoners, some work as docents at the Garden Museum, telling visitors their stories of the hardship they experienced there. Mr. Hossein Khan Ali is one of them. As a political dissident during the 1960s, he spent 5 years in the Shah's prisons.
There was a man in this prison for 30 years, Safar Khan Qahramanian. This man was for a long time in this room. For 16 years since he was arrested, no one was allowed to visit him. After 16 years, he was called up to the meeting room. He couldn't believe it. He was called a few times and he finally went to the meeting room. When he went there, he saw a woman with a little child and a man with her. The woman called him over. As he stood in front of her in the meeting room, she said, Father, I'm your daughter. This is my child and this is my husband. Of all his family, only that girl had been left for him. All others had passed away. And that girl came here every week for the last remaining 14 years to visit her father.
After the events of June 1963, led by Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, SAVAK, an intelligence agency, turned into a secret police to crush any signs of revolt. And the Iron Fist became the signature of this fearsome organization. Habeas corpus was no longer a right for all people, and forced confessions and long detentions became SAVAK's repeat prescription for any political dissident.
در سال 42 بعد از قضایای 15 خرداد
In 1963, after the demonstrations of June the 5th and 6th, it was decided that suppressing the opponents had to be more vigorous and more extensive, and the opponents had to be treated more violently.
سازمان موساد به کمک ساواک آمد و موساد هم یه دفتری رو
It was here that the Mossad came to help SAVAK, and the Mossad also established an office in SAVAK and began to train, equip, and exchange information with SAVAK.
The 1953 coup ushered in the emergence of leftist parties. Though they couldn't play an important role in the political arena of a religious country like Iran, while the religious movement led by Ayatollah Khomeini aimed to raise public awareness, the leftist groups took arms to fight against the regime. Mr. Davood As-Sadi Khamenei was a founding member of the Islamic Society of Students in Stockholm. In 1977, soon after his return to Iran, As-Sadi was arrested for political activities inside the country. After a six-month interrogation, he was transferred to the Qasr prison. For him, there were two main ideologies in the prison.
In those days, there were two points of view for the struggle. Some held that the struggle must be a cultural struggle. From a cultural perspective, the society must reach a level so as not to accept a person as Shah. But there were some people that believed in the armed struggle. They aimed to announce their stance by killing the people near the Shah. And among those two groups, there were some people that believed in a combination of a cultural and an armed struggle. Anyway, this issue that the movement must be purely cultural was one of the views at the time which was preferred by many figures, that is, those who were intellectual.
In 1972, as the armed struggle against the Pahlavi regime gathered momentum, the Joint Counter-Sabotage Committee was founded, aiming to establish close liaison between different security agencies and armed forces to confront the opponents. At the same time, a new prison was given to the committee. Many prisoners were killed in this prison under the brutal torture of SAVAK agents. Dr. Mansouri was in prison both before and after 1971. During his second imprisonment in the Joint Counter-Sabotage Committee prison, he suffered harsh interrogation and harrowing tortures.
As سال 50 رژیم شاه برخوردش با زندانیان سیاسی بسیار خشن خصمانه.
From the year 1971, the Pahlavi regime treated political prisoners very brutally and revengefully. Before that, they would treat a political prisoner like a bankrupt in a very ordinary way. But from 1971 on, they were facing people they considered as their sworn enemies who intended to overthrow the regime. The treatment was so brutal that they thought no one would dare go this way or that prisoners would never resume their activities after being released.
After the year 1971, the regime had initiated a shake-up in the way they treated political dissidents. Almost all of those arrested for political reasons underwent long, excruciating interrogations.
یک روز عصری حالا گویا بازجوها بیکار بودن حوصله‌شون سر رفته بود
One afternoon, it seemed that the interrogators had nothing to do and were bored. They called me and another young man who had come from abroad, and I didn't know him. They put us in front of each other, forcing us to beat each other, but we didn't. They told him to beat me. He refused, and therefore they gave him a beating. Then they left him alone and told me to beat him. I also refused, and then they gave me a beating. They beat me very hard. Then another interrogator arrived and said, "I know this guy. He is not an important person. Take him to the cell and release him tomorrow." They grabbed my arms and dragged me back into the cell. 1 week passed by, but no one came to release me. After 1 week, they called me and took me directly to the torture room. Usually they would take us to the interrogation room and then to the torture room. They took me directly to the torture room. They aimed to break one's concentration so that one couldn't speak about anything in a measured way.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we would like to analyze a question that has often been asked, especially important today. That question is about bid'at. What exactly is bid'at? You know, there's a lot of extremism in religion in general, and especially in Islam in particular. And there's a lot of followers of a lot of sects in Islam accuse others, the followers of other sects, of being innovators in religion, Ahlul Bid, right? And, you know, they accuse them and they say they're going to go to hell. Everything you do is bid'at, you know. But a lot of times, if you ask them what exactly is bid'at, not many of them can kind of properly answer the question. So today we're going to look at the answer to this question. Fortunately, this has been addressed in a lot of the hadith that we have. But before we get to that, in general terms, let's look at the vice of bid'at. Why is it is bad? And the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, "The worst of matters are the innovations. Certainly, every innovation is a source of error, and every error is destined for hell." Right? So yes, bid'at is bad. Imam Ali al-Islam also said, "No sooner is an innovation initiated than it leaves behind a common practice. So eschew innovations and adhere to the clear path. Verily, the established traditions are the best, while innovated ones are the worst." And he also said, "Nothing destroys religion like innovations." Yeah, so innovations are wrong. It is bad. Bid'at is wrong. It's correct. It's not good. But what is an innovation? Fortunately, we have a couple of hadiths can help elucidate the meaning of what bid'at is. Imam Ali is somebody who all Islamic sects agree upon, that, you know, to his knowledge, his virtuousness, his character, everybody agrees upon it, right? Not only do the Shia agree that he is, and you know, their Imam, but also the Ahl-Sunnah agree that he was the one of the greatest of companions of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. Imam Ali alayhi salam said, "The innovators are those who contradict the command of Allah, His Book, and His Messenger. They are those who follow their own opinion and desires, even if they are the majority." Right? So bid'at, right, it implies that you are contradicting the rules of God that have been particularly set out in the Book of God and in the Sunnah of the Prophet. Otherwise, if somebody is not doing that, why would he be committing a bidat? Right? First, you should establish that such and such an act has been prohibited within Islam, right? Prohibited by the Quran, prohibited by, you know, the Sunnah of the Prophet, from the Prophet. If you then you see that somebody is contradicting it, then you can say that, oh, this person is establishing an innovation in religion. Otherwise, if it's not, then why would we call that a bidat? Why would we call that an innovation in religion? Imam Sadiq also said the following. Imam Sadiq, he says, is another person who all of the madahib, all of the sects within Islam, except all of the founders of all of the Islamic sects were students of this Imam. He said, anyone who calls people to give him their allegiance, knowing that among them is someone superior to him, this is an erroneous innovator. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at innovation in religion and what it is. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we will listen to the speech of Sheikh Osama Abdul Ghani.